Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signe Darpinian, co-author of No Way and Raising Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. Would you like to know more about how you can create new meaning while traveling with grief? Or become grief and death literate so you can support those who have lost their person? Joining us today for this topic is Dr. Linda Shanti. Dr. Shanti is a licensed clinical psychologist who specializes in grief, eating disorder recovery, and is a licensed soul collage facilitator. She is also a registered expressive arts therapist and author of The Recovery Mama Guide to Your Eating Disorder Recovery in Pregnancy and Postpartum, as well as her most recent book, After Your Person Dies. Linda, thank you so much for coming to the show today.
Thank you for having me.
So nice to see you, because I haven't seen you in a while.
I know.
It's been a while. So I thought we would start by talking about a note that I saw in the introduction of your most recent book, After Your Person Dies, where you talked about the doctorate program in psychology really not preparing you for the grief that you experienced when your husband dies.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, even like most people, I really had no experience with grief and death before grief and death happened to me.
Yeah.
To my loved ones. And I look back on my graduate program, and I'm not saying this to throw my graduate program under the bus, because I actually loved my graduate program. It was a great graduate program. I think it is not uncommon, just like it's not uncommon for medical doctors to not have any training in eating disorders. I think it is not uncommon for psychologists and therapists to have no training in grief and death. And I just find that so ironic now reflecting on it, because grief and death is going to happen to 100% of us, 100%, like 100% guaranteed. We are all going to die. Everyone we love is going to die. And so everyone is going to grieve. And yet, no training.
Well, and you know what's kind of scary is that you think as a therapist, or at least this is the way that I thought, you think you have this base in grief. But really, you do not.
No,
and
you do not.
You do not. And you don't know what you don't know. And there's so many things that stood out about the book. But the one thing that you said made me think of this part where you say that once you actually experience it, because there's this experiential learning. So mm-hmm. I imagine even if you did know about it, it's different than experiencing it. But you said once you experience it, it's no longer this theoretical concept to you anymore that we're all going to die.
Right. Yeah, it absolutely changes you. It absolutely changes you. And for a lot of us, that leads to post-traumatic growth. What I would say for me personally is that when my husband died. Well, but my dad and my husband died, both died in 2019. And that was really my first experience with big personal loss. I had grandparents die. And, you know, our family, like many families, did try to kind of keep a lot of grief and death away from the children in the service of trying to protect them, which now looking back on that, I'm not sure was very wise. I reflect now on, as a parent, before my son's dad died, I would try to like censor movies, not even like adult movies, just like Disney movies where there was death. You know, good luck trying to find a Disney movie without a parent dying. Mm. Like, have you ever noticed that?
Now I can't think of one.
Right?
Yeah.
And Walt Disney's mom died. So that's interesting. But anyway, after my husband died in particular, I had a whole other experience, right, of grief and death. And before that, I thought, okay, that's just a sad, scary thing. And it's going to be mostly sad. And it'll probably last for up to a year. And then you move on. And then there's these stages, and they're not necessarily linear, but there are these stages, and you go through them, and then at day 366, you move on. And that's what grief and death look like.
And that is not what grief and death look like.
It's not what they look like at all. But nobody knows that, I don't think, until you actually experience it.
When you would censor the kid movies and try to protect your son from seeing scenes with a parent dying or death, is that before your husband died?
Yeah.
That was before. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Now my son and I have like a lot of gallows humor.
Got it.
We're like, we have movie night every Friday, and every Friday we're like, we look at each other and we're like, who do you think's going to die this time? You know, it went before we watch a movie.
Even if we did have adequate grief training in our graduate programs for psychology, could it help that much without experiencing it?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think we need both. Both okay. being more grief and death literacy within our culture. Mm-hmm. Because it's a normal part of life. Everybody's born, everybody dies. It's a normal part of life.
We don't like to accept that reality.
No.
You know, when you talk about losing your father and losing your husband, I haven't had one of those losses. So I resonate with the things that you're talking about with this grief illiterate culture, you know, where it's like, well, that's just something that happens to other people. Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, David Kessler talks about the death defines the grief. We do, I think, often have an expectation that death will happen late in life from a progressive disease in an expected way.
Yes.
You know, and death does not happen that way a lot of times, but sometimes it does, right?
Right.
And when it does, like my dad is actually a good example of that. He had Parkinson's for 30 years. It was progressive. When he died, it felt like the right time.
Mm, okay.
It felt appropriate. It felt, it's never going to feel good, right? It didn't feel good. But my grief around my dad is very different than my grief around my husband.
Is that what you mean by the death defines the grief?
Right.
I see.
So, you know, I work with a lot of grieving people now. And so I've heard a lot of different ways to die. And sudden traumatic deaths can be more, there's an aspect of the grief then that deals with maybe PTSD symptoms, right? Mm-hmm. Or if someone dies young, that's all relevant, right? If it's especially kind of tragic and horrific if it's your young child, which also happens, right? Or a baby, or, you know, these things happen. They happen. But the grief is different, right? Around the loss of a child versus a loss of a parent that was 96 and had Alzheimer's and, you know, for 20 years and right. Versus someone that died suddenly in a car accident, aged 32, you know, you can just imagine just by listening to those scenarios viscerally.
And I can also kind of feel my body tensing up at the ones that aren't okay with me.
Right.
I mean, not that any of it's okay, but it's like, I can kind of feel the whole, oh no, that happens to other people kind of feeling, like a disconnect.
Right. And then that's really good to notice, right? Because then those are the people that when they're grieving are likely to feel more estranged.
Mm.
Right?
Yes.
Because it's so hard for the grief adjacent to imagine being in their position. You imagine being like a parent and you're like, oh, I can't go there.
I mean, I can definitely relate to not knowing what to say, so then choosing right. not to say anything, which is not right. okay.
So here's the thing. It's, I mean, even for me, like at this point, I've actually, since my husband has died, I work with people that, you know, have had their person die, their person being, you know, all kinds of people. And I've had more of my loved ones die. And I've also had family members who have had loved ones die. And even being someone, you know, that has had several people die and is trained in grief counseling, it's hard for me to know what to say. So I think it's the first thing is to forgive yourself for not knowing what to say, because there's not really, the thing about grief is you can't fix it.
Right.
Like nothing right. you say will make it better.
Yeah.
Nothing you, so the, for, I think the first piece for people like the grief adjacent people is to just kind of take a couple of breaths with your own feelings of powerlessness. And then don't put that on the grieving person.
Well said.
Don't try and make it better for them. Because whatever you're experiencing being near them is 100 million times worse for them right now. And that's why it hurts so much when someone says, oh, just let me know what I can do. I'm right nearby. And then first of all, the grieving person does not know what they need. They are in an alternate universe. They don't know what they need. They're not even in touch with, you know, they're not in touch with their hunger and satiety cues.
Yeah.
they're having trouble sleeping. You know, they can't think straight. You know, they're in an alternate universe. They're probably numb. You know, they can't tell you, oh, here's what I need. I don't know.
So when you say like, oh, I'm here for you, just know that I'm here for you, or let me know what I can do, it sounds like it's asking this huge question instead of saying, what would be helpful? Like, can you think of something that would be helpful instead of saying like, just let me know if
just
you need something
know.
In an open-ended yeah, way? Yeah. What would be right. helpful in place right. of that?
Yeah, I actually wrote a blog on this. It's called Dear Casserole People. And I think also, again, forgive yourself for like, that's the natural inclination is to sure. say, let me know, I'm here, you know, but then pause yourself. And I would say if it's someone that you know well enough to know something that would be helpful, you know, like if they're someone whose spouse has died that has children, say, I'm going to take your kids on a play date on Wednesday. Does that work? Just write yes or no. If it works, great. I'll be there at 4 p.m. If not, no worries. I'll try again.
Instead of making it multiple choice, just narrow it down. I'm going to pick them up on Tuesday at 4 o'clock for a play date. Is that okay? Then get consent.
Yeah. Get consent. Like, yeah, give them the choice, right? Don't right. like, don't be like, you know, don't like come storming into their house yeah. and take their children.
I'm taking the kids.
I'm taking yeah. them. Yeah. But like, try to be as specific as possible, guessing, you know, just empathically imagine what you know from them. Like, oh, I know, you know, da da da. Like Wednesdays tend to be hard for them. I'm going to say, you know, can I take your kids for a play date Wednesday, you know, 4 to 6 or I know your kids love macaroni and cheese, and I know you're gluten-free, so I'm going to bring over a gluten-free macaroni and cheese Thursday. I'll put it on your porch. Just write no if you don't want it. Otherwise, I'll leave it there. And then don't come to the door and ring the doorbell and expect them to like gush with gratitude and yeah. say, thank you so much. You saved us from everything. Let me tell you about my grief and then I can cry on your shoulder and then you'll feel like a good human. Don't do that. Just leave it on the porch.
Right.
They'll tell you if they don't want it. And you tell yourself you're a good human.
Yes.
But don't put that mental load on them. And if they say no, don't take it personally at all. They're okay. in so much pain. Do not take it personally.
It's occurring to me that we didn't speak about what led you to your training in grief. We've mentioned it sort of on the periphery, but I don't know if you'd feel comfortable talking about what did happen.
Yeah. Well, so So in 2019, my husband died of cancer. I spent the first year just doing my own grieving, basically. And what I will say about grief is it is, even though it is a universal experience that I want to normalize, the way people experience it is individual. So, but, and I'm going to quote David Kessler again, because he's so great at these one-liners. People grieve in temperament, or sorry, people grieve in character is what he says. So in other words, if you tend to be an introverted person, you're probably not going to be shouting about grief from the rooftops and joining large grief camps and grief groups and, you know, doing podcasts. Maybe you do podcasts because even though it goes out to a lot of people, there's only two people talking. If you're a pragmatic person, you're going to be a person that probably settles the estate in the first 3 months, you know? Right? Because that's how you do, you know, people grieve in character.
So you grieve in a way that matches who you were before your loss.
Right. So since I'm very post-traumatic growthy oriented, you know, I'm a therapist, I'm totally all about personal growth, and I'm an artist. I made a lot of art the first year. I made a lot of art. Right.
Okay.
And I did a lot of personal growth work. And then that turned into the book. And then I was like, oh gosh, I just really want to do this more professionally. So then I got certified in grief counseling, and that's how the grief counseling came in.
Linda, in your book, I wish the listeners could see the beautiful visuals. You illustrated the book yourself, and it is, the hard copy book is just gorgeous. I noticed that there are six women in the illustrations, and it starts with the first woman, she's blue, and then she changes colors to, I have the book right now, I'm cheating. She turns to red, and then I'm still cheating. She turns to
purple.
Okay. So can you tell us, you just mentioned that your husband died in 2019 of cancer. When did the stages start for you?
Okay. I think the five and now six stages of grief, and I'll say more about that in a minute, are very helpful in some ways, and very, they do our culture a disservice in other ways.
Okay.
But the book, the different colors in that painting loosely represent the six stages of grief. And the sixth one is finding meaning. And David Kessler just added that sixth stage in his latest book, The Six Stages of Grief. And he worked with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross on The Five Stages of Grief, which was originally published in 1969, so a long time ago. And Kubler-Ross's original vision of those five stages was, they were describing people with a terminal illness learning to face their own death. Yeah. And clinicians have an acronym, DABDA. I don't know if you've heard that one before. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance, DABDA. That's the five stages. And they were never scientifically proven. There's no evidence that people move through this stage one through five linearly. It's not an evidence-based theory at all.
I didn't realize that. But I also never thought of it. You know, that is interesting. Okay.
Right. Yes. And so I don't know how it got so prominent in popular culture, but people think grief and they think the five stages, right? There are so many grief theories, which I would love to talk about, that in my experience are more accurate and are more evidence-based. But I don't want to throw five stages under the bus because I think they're helpful too. And here's how I think about how they're helpful. They are descriptive, not prescriptive. So they do, I think they do a great job of describing what it feels like to travel with grief. And I say with rather than through because we're never done. It doesn't end. It's a path. It's a journey. It's not a destination. But do we go through like different experiences of being in denial and acceptance and anger and finding meaning and depression and bargaining? Yeah. Over and over and over.
Okay.
Over and over and over. That's the experience of grief.
Instead of the way we think of it, which is arriving to the fifth stage and sort of hanging there. And sort of hanging there.
And then
you've
moved on.
Yeah. Or maybe something kind of pops you back up to an early stage, but for the most part, you're at that later stage.
Right. The experiences are over and over.
Okay.
What I would say over time in the natural progression of grief, when grief doesn't become prolonged grief disorder.
Oh,
which
okay.
Is, right. So we can talk about that. But when grief is, you know, in its natural, like human, we're all wired for grief because we're all going to experience grief. It does, in my experience, and most people I see that don't have prolonged grief disorder, it gets different over time. And it gets, I hate to use this word, better, because it's not like, you know, like a broken bone. Although it is kind of like a broken bone in the sense of it heals, but it's always going to be different.
Okay, so Linda, you talked about the five stages as we've known them, but now there are six stages, and the sixth one being around finding meaning. What did finding meaning look like for you?
Yes. Okay. I mean, I think it was, in a way, kind of a natural place for me to build new strength because, you know, because I'm an art therapist, I kind of already live in that symbolic land a lot, like as existential growth. And so say, for example, and this is going to sound woo-woo, but a lot of people who have had a loved one die have this experience where I will see symbols that are my husband sending me signs. Mm-hmm. So I painted a lot of those symbols. Right. So I painted that. So I decorated our house. I bought a new house after, cause we moved after my husband died. And our new home has a lot of hummingbirds and butterflies all over the house. Right. And we have pictures of my husband too. But the symbols seem to provide a connection, that continuing bonds with him while also making new meaning. Like they're open enough to not just remind me of the loss, but of the ongoing connection. And they're open enough to kind of move forward in this new way and create this new life without forgetting him, without leaving him behind, while also not living in the past, while also still being in the land of the living, while still maintaining connection with him and building new strengths and connections in this new life that my son and I have, rather than having this house full of pictures of dead people, for lack of a better way of putting it. I mean, we do have some photos of him, but I didn't want to have the whole house be like this, feel like a memorial.
I see. I follow. Thanks for that example. That makes sense. So many parts of the book stood out to me. And what I really liked about the book is that, to me, it seems like a book you could read in one good long sitting, like I did. And I sent you an email to let you know I was kind of a blubbering mess at the end, in a good way. It's just beautiful. But it's also a book that I feel like you could read each section at a very slow pace because each section is packed full of so much meaning. And there was this section that talked about the things that your person leaves behind. And it stood out to me because you talked about something along the lines of their wallet, their wedding ring, the clothes they slept in or the clothes they skied in, what to do with the things. Can you say mm-hmm. more about that? I've heard people speaking about it. And it's like when I read it in the book, it kind of came to full circle, like, oh, you know, because I've not had that kind of loss. That's not something I know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I would say before and after, like earlier me would totally relate to you. Like, I don't know, you know, right. And I would have thought earlier me would have thought in very black and white terms, because that's how we think in a grief illiterate culture. Like, okay, you pack up the things and you move on, right? That's what you do. Or you donate the things, or you keep a few mementos and then you move on. Like, and it's probably done in like a month or 12 months.
Well, I'm here to tell you it is not.
But I think grief illiterate me just didn't even think about the things that are left behind. Oh. You know, like, whoa, uh-huh. like the clothes that they slept in, the wedding ring that, you know, it just really right. made me think about the things they left behind. Yeah. So I wasn't even thinking yeah. of it as in a pragmatic way. I just hadn't occurred to me, but it has been brought up, you know, like, oh gosh, you know, this person, how is it going through, you know, her mom's things? And when people talk about it, I'm on the periphery of it. I don't mm-hmm. really get what it means.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that I don't think there's a right or wrong way, you know, pragmatically. And I just want to say that because if there's anybody listening that is traveling with grief, there can be a lot of pressure on you to do things in a certain way. There can be a lot of expectations. You do this, you don't do this. You know, that can be experienced in a lot of ways. That can be experienced in one of the ways could be like around the things. You should, mm-hmm. you know, and we always know that's a problem when a statement starts with a should. You should, you know, pack up all the things within this amount of time, or you should do this, and you don't have to do anything. You can do whatever you want, you know. I personally think there's a lot of creative ways to work with the things they leave behind in a way to make new meaning, you know. And because I'm a widow, like one of the things is the wedding ring, right? Mm-hmm. What do you do with their wedding ring? What do you do with your wedding ring? And, you know, there's a million different things to do with that. I work with widows, so I know, like, you know, some people leave it on forever. My mom still wears her wedding ring. I left mine on for a year, and then I did a painting of a butterfly that I saw after he died, and I put it on that painting, and now I wear a butterfly ring on my other hand. You know, I know some people that make bracelets or necklaces out of their wedding rings. I know, you know, there's so many things. Or for kids, you can make quilts of their clothing from their things. You know, there's so many things you can do to bring their memory with you forward.
I like the way that sounds.
You know?
The way that your husband left his paint box and you decided that the best use for it was to make a painting of it for your book.
Okay. Yeah, and I think when you as the griever give yourself permission to hold it as a question rather than as a should, you know, like, I wonder what I would like to do with this thing. Rather than I should, you know, get rid of this thing. I should give this thing away. I should preserve this thing. I shouldn't use this thing. I should, you know, all that. And you as a grief adjacent person, you know, just don't should on them. Mm-hmm. If your dad's wife died, and he's still hanging on to her phone 2 years after she died because he wants to hear her voice on the phone, and he's too technically challenged to figure out how to get it recorded onto something else. So what? don't should on him. Or offer to pay for the phone. Offer to pay for the phone subscription for keeping two phones rather than one.
Okay, I like it. And if you asking the, I wonder what I will do with this phone. Is that an example?
Yeah, that's great. Rather than, you know, you need to get rid of the phone.
It leaves more room for the right answer for you to unfold. Speaking of things, we talked about wedding rings. What about romantic relationships after becoming a widow? What do you...
Yeah, that is a hot topic in all the widow groups. It's a hot topic.
I didn't know exactly how to ask it.
No comment.
I didn't
know. Just kidding. Yeah. No, I'll talk about that. But I don't have any prescriptions. So I'll say that. No prescriptions. And I have no unsolicited advice. Other than if you're a widow or a widower, you do you. And you just have some really good boundaries around other people's opinions. Because let me tell you, people have opinions.
Mm.
People have opinions on this topic, especially non-widows and non-widowers.
Mm.
Wow, do they have opinions.
Gosh.
So if you're one of those people, I want to encourage you to keep your opinion to yourself until you are a widower. That's what I would say, unsolicited advice in that area. I would say if you're a widow, maybe if you're a widower too, I don't have that experience.
I don't think I know the difference between a widow and a widower.
Oh, just widower is a male.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't want to ask, but it was burning inside of me, so I had to. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, sorry, I interrupted you.
The things you learn.
Yes.
So I would say, one thing that I would kind of normalize, because I think this is one of the pieces that's hard for, I know it's hard for widows. It might be for widowers too. I'm not sure because I work primarily with widows. But I would say if you do date and you find yourself comparing, and when I say that, I mean, because for a lot of widows, they, or I'll say we, have not dated in many years, right?
Mm-hmm.
We were married. You know, some people, you know, 30 years, they haven't dated in 30 years. Like, they didn't have online dating then. I met my husband in high school, you know. But even if it's not 30 years, even if it's, you know, only 2 years ago, it's still, if you were happily married and your person dies, and then you date again, it's going to be natural to compare them to your late spouse. It's just going to happen. So I'm not going to say don't compare, because your brain will do that. They are deeply embedded into your attachment system, you know, right?
Oh, yeah.
So of course you're going to compare. Your brain is going to go there. Your brain is going to go, oh, how does this first date compare to my first date with my late person? It's just going to happen. So I would say, don't judge yourself when you compare. It's okay. It's a natural phenomenon. Okay. Then I would say, remind yourself, not only is the person that you are sitting in front of on this date with a different person, so try and keep an open mind and let them be themselves. They're a different person, but you are a different person. You are a different person now than when you dated your late spouse. So, right? I think that's a really great way to think about it. Because if you dated your late spouse when you were 20 and now you're 50 or 70, you're not the same person. So if you're going to compare and despair, you have to be fair, right?
Oh.
Same thing with eating disorder recovery. If you're going to compare and despair, you have to be fair. So don't compare your 70-year-old self to your 20-year-old self, because your 70-year-old self has been through a lot of shit.
Okay.
That your 20-year-old self has not.
Wow. Yeah, that is so good.
There was such a great New York Times articles recently about this, like dating in middle age.
I feel like I saw that.
Yeah, and it was a really great article about, like, okay, look it. let's just be real. It's going to be different. It's very different. So why not use that to your advantage and say, oh, look at the ways I'm different. For example, I am not looking for someone to take care of me financially. Or, for example, my sexual needs now are very different. Or, for example, I am not looking to have children. Or, for example, I really would love to travel. Or, for example, I have found out I don't really want to travel. Or, for example, I've discovered I'm a dog lover. Or, for example, I've discovered I really don't like dogs. Or,
you know what I mean? You know, like, you know what I hear people sometimes saying is, let's say the widow or the widower, which I make no comment about because what do I know? They'll sometimes say that, oh, it's just never going to be the same.
Well, I think that's true.
Okay, fair enough.
I think that's true. And I think you get to decide what kind of tone and story you attach to that.
Okay.
Because if it's said as a martyr, then...
What do you mean by that?
Oh, my life is over.
I see.
It's never going to be the same. Instead of, yeah, it's never going to be the same. I mean, you could say it's never going to be the same and decide to date. And you could decide it's never going to be the same and decide not to date. I personally think it's the most important piece is you make that decision from an empowered place, which is to accept that. I might cry here. You will always love your person and nothing will ever change that. Nothing. Whether you date or not date. Can you find love again? Absolutely. Is it going to be your dead person? No. Can you love them like as much as you loved your person? Absolutely. Mm. Like if you have more than one child, do you like love your second child less?
I only have one child, so I can't imagine.
I only have one child too, but I can imagine.
The love is so big, I can't imagine loving two, but I see people doing it. Linda, what are your thoughts about the term pathological grieving?
Well, I'm not a big fan of pathologizing. Mm-hmm. that being said, I would say in terms of, you know, as a therapist, I know that the latest book that we therapists use, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, has added prolonged grief disorder. I think the main benefit of, in a non-pathologizing way, of adding that to the DSM is that people that are experiencing this can have their therapy covered by insurance now.
Oh, I think that is the main,
right? I think that is the main benefit.
Oh.
But prolonged grief disorder is basically if you have had symptoms of grief that interfere in normal functioning for a year or more. And when I say interfering in functioning, I don't mean that you're still thinking about your person. I don't mean that you don't still feel sad. I don't mean that you need to move on. I mean more if you're having trouble working. I mean more if you're having trouble connecting with other family members, if you're isolated from support, if you're... You know, just like we think about with, you know, substance use or disordered eating, right? It becomes a problem when that is interfering with your life.
Linda, do you think that everyone who experiences a significant loss like this should receive grief counseling?
This is going to sound weird coming from a grief counselor that's totally into personal growth and loves therapy and blah, blah, blah. I don't think everybody that's grieving needs grief counseling at all. I do not think that everybody needs grief counseling. I think grief counseling is something you can seek out and it's super helpful. Do I think it's necessary? Not always.
Okay.
Not always.
Linda, you and I in the work that we do are often dealing with body image grief. And in this case, I mean loss of body maybe as somebody has known it. Can you explain the differences between the different types of grief?
Body image grief, I'd probably put maybe under the category of, or the terminology of ambiguous grief.
Oh, okay.
Maybe, which is, you know, from Dr. Pauline Boss in the 1970s. And she talks about ambiguous grief being non-death related losses.
Oh, I see.
So, for example, when you're grieving a parent who has Alzheimer's but is not dead.
Yes.
Or I think originally maybe she was looking at soldiers that were missing in action but not necessarily dead, you know, and that led to very ambiguous grief, understandably. But I think it's been expanded to other non-death related losses like divorce,
yes,
or loss of a job or a career, or loss of your identity. And that's kind of where I, you know, when I work with people recovering from eating disorders, I see them dealing with grief around body image when, like, for example, they get into recovery and they're grieving their former self. Or especially with, I also work with women in perinatal, like postpartum, that have had an eating disorder. And whoo, is body image rough postpartum for them. And it is about their body and it's not about their body, right? You know, you do this work. So I think the grief piece there is around acceptance of I am not the same person. Just like, I mean, it's similar in the sense of when your loved one dies, you're never going to be the same. Like after you become a mother, you're never going to be the same person. You're a completely different person. And then it's kind of an illusion that our culture upholds in a harmful way that getting your pre-baby body back is gonna like restore you to some kind of like pre-baby self, because you're never gonna be the same person.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about the way the similarities in the grief in that way. I mean, there's obvious differences, but I hadn't thought about those similarities. Well, Linda, thank you so much for the honest reflection in your book, After Your Person Dies, and providing a roadmap for those traveling with grief, as well as those hoping to learn how to best support loved ones that have lost their person. I feel so much more grief and death literate than I did before. Doesn't mean that I'm there. I just have a better base. And now I feel like I know more of what I do know and do not know. And just thank you for taking the time, you know, and coming to talk to us about this today.
Well, thank you so much for creating a forum for this.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And feel free to contact me at www.signadarpinian.com. We'll see you next month.